Hey guys, and welcome to the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. The first podcast to bring you the local fishing report for Alabama's lakes and rivers, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. I'm your host, Nick Williams, and this week's show is brought to you by... Alrighty guys, welcome back to another week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report. We're sitting here trying to stay cool in the pool down in South Alabama, lounging around in the heat of the day, waiting for evening when you can actually go outside and draw a breath of air. And while we wait, we're here to talk with Stephen Rockhart. Stephen, how you doing this week?
I'm doing great, and that's a pretty good opening statement right there.
Man, it surprises me every year. I've lived here my whole life, and I never get used to how hot it gets in the summertime and humid. And right here on the river, goodness gracious, like you literally, it's I know everybody listening in has had this moment. Like you get home in the evening, you shower, you change out of your work clothes, and then heaven forbid you got to go check the mail or run the trash can back up to the house or whatever, and just walking out and walking back in, you're like, yep, I need another shower.
Yeah, you're dripping. There's no way around it.
Yeah, it is. Man, it is something. It's this time of the year. Sometimes I won't lie, I get a little bit jealous of the fishing guides. Like, man, it'd be nice to be out there on the water every day. And June, July, August, I'm like, man, I'll keep my desk jockey position.
Well, I'll be honest, it's still hot out there too. So, but you can go for a swim if you want to. Just kind of jump in the river for a few minutes and you're good to go.
There we go. Well, it's been a while since we had you on the show. What before we get into the report, what you been up to, man? You been fishing any new water or seeing any new things?
Yeah, I've been staying pretty busy. It's one of the reasons why it's taking me a little bit to get back on. Been fishing several days a week and taking people out several days a week. And between me and the other fellas, we've been working on the river. But it's been a good spring so far. The fish are, fish tend to change just a little bit. You can always kind of know what they want. But then, you know, they'll throw you a curveball and say, I don't think I want that anymore. So we've had a couple of those instances this year where, you know, you think fishing's going great and then all of a sudden they switch it up on you, then you change it up and then you get right back on them and you're like, well, glad that worked. But yeah, overall, it's been a good year so far. It's been a great season. It's been getting a little dry. You know, last year we had the perfect amount of rain. It was very consistent. We didn't have a significant amount of flooding. And this year we had kind of the opposite. We had a couple big floods, fairly consistent rain, and then absolutely no rain much earlier than anticipated. So I'm hoping we get a little bit more rain here in the next couple weeks. That way the fishing will stay pretty strong. But yeah, fishing's going good, man. Just kind of eating it up and enjoying each and every day.
Is it a concern up there on the Cahaba? Like I know, you know, y'all got some shoals up there. Like, does it ever dry up and get to the point where it's hard to make a run on it if you're floating it?
110%. So that's probably the major complication that we have, is because you'll run into the same problem every single year. Granted, it fluctuates by about anywhere between 1 to 3 or 4 weeks, where we'll get to the point where the river gets down to a certain level. And I mean, you can get through some sections of shoals, but some of these shoal sections are, you know, anywhere between 100 feet to 300, 400, 500 feet. And being able to get a raft and clients and gear and food and all that stuff that you have, it becomes quite cumbersome. And you kind of have to change your approach whenever you get to those situations. You have to say, okay, well, let's go to the larger sections in the river. Let's get our motor and let's go upriver and let's go to as far as we can go up to the base of these shoals, and then we'll come back down. So doing a pure or a normal A to B point location, or point A to point B trip, is not as, I guess, doable this time of year, but it doesn't necessarily affect the fishing so much, as long as you still know where the fish hold and how to target them. You could still have just as good of a day as any. It's just, well, it looks like we're putting in point A or point B and we're taking out at point B. So yeah, it just kind of depends. You got to kind of figure that out, and you have to, you know, at the end of the day, and this goes for everybody and everybody that guides knows this, you have to know your water. You have to know where fish hold. You have to know how fish move. But you have to take care of yourself at the same time. You can't beat yourself up and give your client a terrible day by dragging them through 3 or 4 hours of shoals just to get some decent fishing. So it usually works out at the end, as long as you can find a good couple bites or something like that.
Yeah. Is there kind of a trade-off? Like, the navigability obviously gets worse when the water gets low. But like, I know I had last year, I had some trips up around Talladega National Forest and up around Fort Payne up there on Little River, where I caught the water. Like you said, it was dry and there wasn't a lot of water. And it was, at first you'd get out and you looked at the water and you were like, wow, like that's less water than I think I've ever seen up here. And I almost turned around and then I was like, well, I guess if there's a pool, that's the only place the fish can be. Does it tend to concentrate the fishing any?
Absolutely. There is a significant payoff for that. Yes. So even though the water may be low and clear and it may be more challenging to cover the ground, it does allow you to have a pretty big benefit of targeting fish and knowing where the fish are. I mean, they can't be anywhere else. You know, the river, you've got pocket water on the left and you've got dry river above you. You've got dry river below you, and then pocket water below that dry run. And, you know, that's where the fish are going to be. And in turn, until it gets to be, you know, August and July or July and August, those fish stay pretty active and they're gonna show face, and those big fish are gonna start turning up and they'll start cruising under the surface of the water, and you'll see them kind of looking for food. And yeah, there's a lot of opportunity in it. It's just, okay, well now we have a different challenge. So you know, in the springtime you don't have visibility, but you do have migratory fish patterns. Again, they don't move a significant amount in these rivers and creeks, but they do move. They move to better breeding grounds, or they follow the bait fish a lot, things like that, right? Or moving into the lower clear water time of year where your casts are really important. You're probably going to be fishing floating line. You're probably going to be fishing some type of topwater frog or cricket, or, you know, katydid imitation, or just a popper, just to keep it simple. Or if you're not doing that, you're going to need to fish something that has a little bit more, I guess, of an appeal to it on below subsurface. So you can't be throwing 3 and 4 and 5 inch, or excuse me, 4 and 5 inch, 6 inch big streamers with a whole bunch of flash and a whole bunch of body on them, because the fish are going to look at you and think, well, that's kind of stupid. And don't get me wrong, you still get some fish that will still eat those, but you're going to have better luck throwing a small, subtle bait fish imitation or helgramite pattern, which is just like a little terrestrial that lives underneath rocks and stuff like that. And then anything kind of simple like that. So you almost have to dial it back a little bit and fish it a little bit with a little bit more finesse. But it's fun, you know, everything always changes, and you just got to be ready for it.
That's definitely, I enjoy fishing like that. And I think it's because I don't get a chance to do it a lot down here because the delta water stays so muddy all the time that you're really relying a lot on flash and vibration. And like you said, something that makes a lot of noise, something that they can find in the dark, so to speak, right? When the water's real murky. But then
Right.
some days I have to remind myself to dial it back. Like I'll get on some of the little blackwater streams down here and they'll start to dry up and they'll get real clear. And or as I say clear, real clear for down here, clear enough that you're sight fishing for them, but it's a very, very different game once, you know, it gets to where you can see the fish and they can see you, and it seems like they're looking at everything in high definition, and
Yep.
they get a lot pickier, they get a lot weirder about things. And then some days it just seems like I almost think it helps. I like that color to the water just because I feel like sometimes you don't want them to get too good of a look at what you're throwing at them. You know, they're just looking for reasons not to hit it sometimes, it seems.
Dude, I 100% agree. I love a little bit of a dinge or a little bit of a temp to the water. And you know how you said, you kind of like picking it apart sometimes, right? Really dialing in and figuring out exactly what they like. And I think that's a lot of the allure to fly fishing. It's being able to be meticulous and very selective for baits in your flies and your retrieves and your whatever you want to do. I mean, it's a world of opportunity. You know, I feel like I know a lot of people, and anytime it comes to fishing and hunting, you can almost not learn enough. You know, there's other way to hunt them or chase them or find them. You can always learn something. So I think fly fishing just adds the extra dynamic of, well, how am I supposed to handle this 50-foot of line in my feet that I keep stepping on top of trying to catch a fish, which adds to frustration, but it's still fun.
What would be that? Because that's something that I struggle with still from time to time, and I've gotten a lot better at it than I was in the first few trips. The first few times you throw a fly rod, it'll about make you never want to pick it up again, especially if you're standing on the shoreline with a bunch of, you know, weeds up underneath your feet, or if you're on a boat like mine. My boat was never rigged up. My little John boat was never rigged up with the thought of having 50 feet of fly line sitting there at your feet. You know, there was you find all the snag potential in your boat the first time you take a fly rod out on it. You take a lot of people guiding. I imagine you see your fair share of new anglers and people that struggle with that. What's your best tips for line management, whether you're on a boat wading, or you know, if somebody's just bank pounding?
So I do something a little bit different than everybody else. It's not something that I necessarily teach people to do because it's one more step, but it's very effective. We'll start with what I do, and then I'll tell you what I make everybody else do. So for me, I just, whenever I strip my line in, I let it loop around two or three fingers in my left hand that I'm pulling the line in with. or I bring it down my left hand and I'll loop it on my right hand that, you know, holding the rod, and I'll just make these large loops, anywhere between 12 and 16 inch loops, and I'll just hang them on my finger, and I start, you know, on the left and feed to the right, or on the right, feed to the left. And then when I'm ready to cast it again, I just slowly let it fall off as I go, and my line will never touch the ground. And that's kind of the, if I'm fishing kind of, you know, slow to medium, that's really easy to do. But if I'm fishing bigger water, if I'm stripping streamers in really fast, or making any type of quicker retrieve, it's almost easier just to get it away from my feet. Your feet tend to be more of your problem than anything else. So I'll tend to put it in the, I'll tend to put my line in the water as long as it doesn't get in the way of the person rowing. I think putting it in the water makes it a lot easier. So I'll put it in the water, and that way, whenever I pull my line back up, it doesn't have grit on it. It's nice and clean. But that, like I said, that also depends on who's on the boat with you. If you got somebody rowing who's like, hey, try to keep most of the rope line in the boat, I don't care if you step on it, then of course you'll have to pay attention to that element. But, you know, don't wear Chacos. They're great shoes, but they'll grab every bit of fly line you ever have, anything with a strap or a buckle on it, shoe-wise. So try to wear something with shoelaces, and that'll take off 50% of your errors with your fly line. But most of the time I just tell people in the boat, you know, just throw it in the water.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, man. I got a pair of Tevas, and I specifically bought them several years ago to use down here during teal season. We get out on some sandbars and do a little bit of teal hunting, and it's so hot, you don't want to wear, you know, chest waders in September in South Alabama. So I'll just have a pair of neutral colored swim trunks and a camouflage shirt and a pair of Tevas, just something to keep from stepping on an oyster shell or, you know, an old beer bottle or something like that. But them Velcro tabs on that pair of Tevas that I had, it didn't take but a couple trips before I found out about those tabs. And I'd never noticed them tabs. I'd owned them pair of shoes for 5 years and never noticed that they had Velcro tabs on them. But the first time I cast fly line on the bank, it was like, well, son of a gun, look at that.
Yep, snag, snag, snag.
Yeah, it's funny that you talk about looping it in your hand. So some of the places I've fished here, just driving around Alabama and fishing on the side of the road, getting off in the weeds on the side of a creek somewhere, that was a trick I picked up pretty early on. And I don't think you're going to see that anywhere online on the Orvis School of Fly Casting or anything, but sometimes it may be bad form, but it's better than it sitting there tangled up in the dewberry bushes that you're knee deep in.
No, you're right. I mean, it is. Just keep it in your hand, keep it close, make your casting, maybe do a couple extra false casts to make sure you don't tangle it up in your hand, and make sure it goes through all those little pilot holes. But hey, it works. It works. The other thing was, and I'll make it real quick, I didn't mention, is lots of people, you know, you go from varying distances on the bank or varying casts. You're like, okay, well, I'm going to fish 20, 30, 40 feet away. And then you go to, okay, maybe I'm fishing 20 or 25 feet away now, or, oh, now all of a sudden I need to make a 50-foot cast. And you make a 50-foot cast, you pull some more line out. Then you go back to that 20, 30-foot distance again. Well, now you've got 15 extra foot of line that's just sitting on the floor, and that's going to constantly get in your way unless you're just an exceptional person with line management. So I usually tell clients a lot, you know, hey, look, now that we've moved a little bit closer, now that we're in this reef, go ahead and just put a little bit of line back on your reel. That way you have less line to worry about. You can always pull more line off. If you need to make a cast and cast it 10 more feet, just give it 3 pulls and then cast it. But try not to have any of that extra line off or on the ground if you don't need it. Just put it back on the reel, cast what you need, and then just kind of rinse and repeat there.
I can definitely see, too. I know that, I guess, things change over the years. It's always been interesting to me to look at how outdoor gear changes over the years. And sometimes it changes back and forth, but like working in, you know, an archery department, talking with the old timers about the arrows that they used to use versus the arrows that were popular when I was younger. Like the old timers would talk about using heavier arrows, you know, big thick aluminum shafts, or, you know, the trad guys were still shooting wood, obviously. There's a few fiberglass and graphite arrows out on the market, and then everything went to carbon fiber. And then you kind of saw the pendulum swing back to heavier arrows again, and two-bladed cut-on contact broadheads and everything like that. And so the trends are interesting to me. And I can tell you what, bank fishing, to me, I can see why it's either out of style now, but automatic fly reels, if you're, you know, your granddaddy, if he was fishing for bluegill on the edge of a, you know, farm pond, it makes a lot of sense. Like the ability to just kind of hit a button and zip all that stuff up and get it off the ground and then walk 20 feet and fish the next place on the pond where you get room to cast. Does anybody, have those just gone completely out of style? I've looked at them a few times in thrift stores and on eBay and stuff like that. Does anybody make a serious automatic fly reel anymore?
I'm sure there's somebody that knows more than me about that, but to be honest, I have not seen anything unless it was 40, 30, 40 years old with an automatic fly reel. So, no, to my knowledge, I do not believe that they are still making them, but for all I know, there's one or two that, have that option. But no, I mean, it's not even in the deck anymore in terms of normal new age fly anglers. It's not even really a thought other than, oh, I've got my granddaddy's old automatic reel. It's real cool. I put it on the old Eagle Claw and this is now my vintage setup that I go catch bream in the pond with, and it's a good memoriam for my father and my grandfather. But no, other than that, I would say I don't see it as a tool in the normal market. So.
Yeah, I don't see anybody using them except, like you said, sometimes you see a nostalgia post or something like that. Somebody getting rid of granddaddy's stuff. You'll have the old U.S. made Zebcos, back when that was a thing, back when those still had metal gears in them and everything. And then, yeah, I had one once upon a time, and it was actually I used it as a storage device. I had some line on there that I would use to pull my bag up when I would climb up in a tree stand deer hunting, and I experimented with that for a little bit, just so that you could zip that line up without having to, wrap it around your fingers and get it all tangled and everything. But then I got rid of it, I think, right before I started fly fishing. Like, I give it to another guy, so that he could put it on his stand and use it, and then I was immediately like, man, I should have held on to that for one more year, and I could have tried it out without having to go buy a new one.
Hey, I've done that with other things and other situations. It's just, it happens, man, you know?
I have definitely, hunting and fishing, I have got rid of a lot of gear that I then immediately regretted getting rid of. And I'm finally starting to learn my lesson and just put it in the attic and keep it for 2 years.
Just keep it.
And then if after 2 years, if you don't need it, then keep it another year and then you can get rid of it.
That's right. Now, I've got some buddies that like to sell and trade guns every once in a while, and they'll always get a gun. They're like, man, I'm so excited to get this. And then this opportunity came around. Man, I got rid of it so fast. And then a year later, they're like, I should have just paid him cash. I should have kept both of them. I should have never gotten rid of that gun. I can't find it anymore. And I'm like, well, sucks for you, brother. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
And it's funny with stuff like that, because when you're young and you're starting out and you want to try different gear, have different things, and money's tight, and so you either buy cheap gear or you'll buy something, and then you'll yeah like I've done that before, sell one thing to pay for another, try something different. But a word of advice I got, an older gentleman told me one time, he said, look, he said, just go ahead and buy it nice. And he said, because this is what's going to happen. You're going to sit there and think, man, I can't afford that. I'll buy it when I'm older. And I forget what he used as an example. It was something like a Remington 870 Wingmaster. And he's like, when I was a younger man, I wanted one, and they were so expensive. I only made this much a year. Was making $6 an hour or whatever it was, and they cost $200. And he says, now I make this much per hour. And he was making four times as much money, but the gun 30 years later cost four times as much. So he's like, just go ahead and get it. He's like, if you can still eat at the end of the day, pay all your bills, he's like, just go ahead and get it now, because it's not going to get any more affordable as you get older.
Isn't that the truth with a lot of stuff?
That's it.
Golly.
That's it. Well, Stephen, I always appreciate having you on the show. I'll let you get back to it. But if people are looking to book a trip on the Cahaba, if they want to make a float up that way, where's a good place to get in touch with you?
Yeah, sounds good. You can reach out at flyfishinalabama.com or on Facebook or Instagram, same thing, flyfishinalabama. And we do other rivers and waterways and stuff like that throughout the state. So just reach out. If I don't know somebody, or if I don't have somebody that does that water or covers that water, I know somebody who can help you, and I'll put you in touch with them. So just reach on out. And my phone number, too, on the website. Y'all can just reach out. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely, guys. Y'all go check Steven out. Steven, drive safe. This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by Visit Mississippi. If you're looking for a beautiful state that's packed with outdoor attractions, check out Mississippi. Of course, you know about the Mississippi River, but there are lots of great rivers for paddling throughout the state. Coastal Mississippi's waters are perfect for deep sea fishing or exploring the state's five uninhabited barrier islands. You'll find national forests with campgrounds, trails and recreational sites, 25 parks, and wildlife management areas too. Whatever you like to do in the great outdoors, you can do in Mississippi, where wanderers are welcome. Plan your adventure at visitmississippi.org/outdoors. Alrighty, guys, next up we have Alex Davis reporting in from the Tennessee River System. He fishes up around Lake Gunnersville. Alex, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Man, I'm doing real good. I'm counting my blessings that I get to just sit here and chill out, because you were just telling me off here you just got done with a pretty big drive, and it kind of made my back hurt hearing about that drive. So
Yeah, I walked in the door about 10 minutes ago from a 18 and a half hour drive, which I broke it down to 2 days. I drove half of it one day and half the next. That makes it a little nicer, but yes, I'm going to be probably just laying in the floor and stretching out tonight. Haven't seen a TV in about 14 days. So it's going to be kind of good to get back to the real world for a little bit.
there we go. There we go. Get back to the real world, but take a little bit of time to decompress first. That sounds like a good plan.
Absolutely.
Tell me, man, it's been a while since we've heard anybody give a bass fishing report up there on old Lake Gunnersville. Everything's getting hot. I know a lot of guys are having to move offshore. We've been talking with some guys who, do some stuff fishing up in tributary streams, fly fishing where that water's a little bit cooler, got a little bit of current. What's the strategy right now as it heats up on Lake Gunnersville? What's your go-to advice?
Well, the cool thing about Gunnersville is a lot of fish, when they get done post-spawn, they stay in the grass. There's a shad spawn, and then they do move offshore. They go to the ledges. But we have so much grass, not all of them go offshore. So you can actually, if you're not a ledge guy and you don't want to fish ledges, offshore ledges, stuff like that, you don't have to. You don't want to deal with the crowds. And a lot of the places you can't even get on. There's always a boat sitting there, and it makes it really frustrating. And the cool thing about Gunnersville is we have so much grass that a lot of them stay. And then usually around Father's Day weekend, that third week in June, from what I've seen year after year after year, is a lot of the fish actually leave the ledges and go back to the grass. And one reason they do this is the shad. A lot of times the shad that's out there on the ledges will actually go to the grass. And it's like anything else. When their food source leaves, so do they. So the cool thing about Gunnersville, you can right now, if you want to, you can take like a big worm, a speed worm, a popper, a spook. You can actually go flip. You can go throw a frog. You never have to break out a big crankbait or a football head jig or a drop shot. You can just solely go fish grass all day, and you'll have a really good time. I mean, there'll be obviously slow periods throughout the day. It's hot. I'd always try to tell people beat the heat, try to get done before 9:30, 10 o'clock, and you have a pretty enjoyable day fishing and you catch fish, and you don't have to go throw a big crankbait if you don't want to.
That sounds like a good time, because I know that's something that I struggle with is trying to fish deeper water and fish offshore. I love fishing grass, fishing near shore structure and stuff like that. You mentioned that pattern you usually noticed it starting around the third weekend. I know Father's Day was last weekend. How long do you think those fish are going to stay shallow like that, where people can get at them on the grass?
They'll stay there all summer and all fall. Like I said, the good thing about grass is it harbors bream. It actually harbors crawfish. Shad will go in the grass. And a bass, he only thinks about two things, spawning and eating. So wherever his food is, that's where he's going to want to be. And that's the perfect situation about grass is grass harbors bait. And then that's where the fish come in. They want to eat the bait. They want to eat the bream. They want to eat the crawdad. So it's kind of just a perfect recipe for you can fish grass all year, never have to ever fish ledges on Gunnersville if you don't want to.
That's awesome. I would have, I know I've been to Lake Gunnersville, and I know there's definitely a lot of them back bays have a whole lot of grass. I'm kind of out of the loop all the way down here on the Gulf Coast, but I heard, wasn't there? There's some sort of controversy brewing, or I heard it hit the news with a particular grass or something that had got loose in Gunnersville, or there were some plans to go out there and spray like an herbicide of some sort. Am I misremembering, or is that anything you know about?
Well, we have eelgrass. It's been in here for years and years, and it gets brought up all the time about different things. Like this year, what they did is they actually kept the lake really low in the winter. And the ideal of that was to keep it low, kill the stuff that was in 3 foot, 4 foot or shallower. And then when they up the water, that 6 foot and less would pretty much not have eelgrass. So they're trying to, if they had to spray the whole thing and nuke the lake, it would cost millions upon millions upon millions of dollars. And they've sprayed like a couple years five, six years ago back, they sprayed Roseberry. They just sprayed the entire creek. City put up money. The homeowners put up money and they sprayed the creek. The problem is yeah, for 2 years or a year and a half, 2 years, it's like, oh, there's no grass, but it's coming back. You know, some form of vegetation will always come back. So even if they nuke the whole lake, they know that within 2 years, something's coming back. So it's kind of a wasted money. So they try to come up with plans. They have harvesters on the lake and they you know, they think that helps keeping the water levels down. That helps. And then they do spray around boat ramps and public parks, which, you know, a lot of people, they're against any kind of spraying whatsoever. And I do think there is a place for it, you know, about if they didn't spray around boat ramps, some of these ramps would get clogged in where you could not put your boat in. So I think they do a pretty good job of it. They spray around boathouses and public parks and boat ramps. So I think they do a great job of controlling the vegetation. It just, I've seen when I first moved here, it was all hydrilla and then it turned into mostly milfoil. And then we had a mix of hydrilla and milfoil and then introduced this eelgrass. Now eelgrass is the, you know, the predominant vegetation. And now hydrilla is now making a major comeback. I've seen more hydrilla this year than I have in years past. So it always changes. It's always going to change. It's Mother Nature, and you can't stop Mother Nature. It's going to do what it wants to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I can speak to what you're talking about as far as having to spray around the boat launches and the boathouses, because I've stayed at a couple of places at Gunnersville, and all of them that I stayed at had grass, and it kind of made it hard to fish around that boathouse and to get your boat in and out. And it's frustrating because you're looking at fish down in the grass and you're just trying to figure out how you can get down there to them, punch through that grass and fish for them. It's definitely tricky. That's not something that we have a lot of down here in my neck of the world, but everywhere that there's grass, there's fish in my experience on Gunnersville.
Yeah. Grass makes bass fishing great. So that's kind of, you kind of have to just deal with it. I do feel bad for homeowners in a sense. You know, they obviously spend a lot of money and have nice houses and nice boat houses. But at the same time, I always just say, well, when they moved here, there was grass. So it's kind of I guess it's just one of those things that it's Gunnersville, it has grass, and we all just kind of have to live with it and play fair, play nice with each other.
Absolutely. Well, Alex, I appreciate you being on the show. Good touching base with you. Always good to hear about the crown jewel up there y'all got on the Tennessee River. Coming up, if folks want to book a trip with you, what's a good way to get in touch with you?
Best way to get in touch with me is you can either call or text, and my phone number is 256-298-1178. Send me an email at spinnerbaitkid@gmail. Look me up on Facebook, Instagram, or my website, which is spinnerbaitkid.com.
There we go, guys. If y'all are looking to get up there and fish Lake Gunnersville, y'all go ahead and check out Alex. I can tell you, I was just up on the Tennessee River last weekend, and you can still catch some morning temperatures down in the 60s. It's nice. So y'all go check them out. And Alex, I appreciate you being on the show.
All right. Thank you.
And we're going to take a quick break. Y'all take a minute to check out some of the businesses that keep this show free for you. This week's episode has been brought to you by... All righty, and next up, we have a new contributor to the show. Today, we got Andy Witten with Fly Fishing Alabama. I'm excited to have Andy on. He guides up on the Tennessee River up around Florence, and he specializes in smallmouth bass, which is one of the few black bass that I have not caught. So I'm always interested to talk smallmouth bass. I'm still hoping to make that happen this year. Andy, what's my prognosis if I get up there this summer to go catch some smallmouth bass? Did you catch them all, or did you leave a few for me?
No, there's still a few left, buddy. You're welcome to come anytime you want to.
Awesome. Well, tell me a little bit, since you're new to the show, usually I have people just kind of introduce themselves. Tell the audience a little bit about yourself. How'd you get fishing? And then how did you end up going from fishing for love to fishing, making a little bit of money on the side, doing some guiding? How'd that happen?
I've been in Florence, born and raised here. My dad used to carry me creek fishing when I was little. I don't know, probably seven, 8 years old, I guess. I started creek fishing a little bit with him. And then when I got on up into high school, I didn't have a boat. So everybody I knew had a boat. So for me, I didn't have a boat. So I was just wade fished all the time. I actually grew up close to where I guide. I grew up in the immediate area. So I stayed on that stretch of water as much as I could after school all the time, on the weekends all the time. I don't know. I like boat fishing, but I'm a wade kind of guy. I like to wade more than I do in a boat. Even now that I got two boats and all that, I like to wade more still. But as far as getting into the whole guiding thing, Steven Rockerts, he'd come down and fish with me a few times. And I always I always liked what Steven was doing. I always liked the head on his shoulders and the way he thought of things. I'd always wanted to kind of guide, but my work schedule was always so messed up that I couldn't guarantee anybody anything as far as like a day, because I was getting forced at work and all this and all that. And then that finally chilled out. So Rockert's come down and fished with me one day and offered me the job to work for him. And I took it. I was kind of skeptical at first. And then at first, first few trips, I was like, maybe I don't like this, but I ended up liking it. I enjoy it more now. Every time I go, I start enjoying it more. But me and my wife, we started wade fishing a lot together. She never really done it. And it got to the point where I was enjoying watching her catch fish more than I did even catching fish. So I think it kind of maybe stemmed off that too. When I got that offer, I thought, I could watch people catch fish all day. That's fine with me.
It kind of reminds me a lot of my own fishing journey, all the way going back what you were saying, being a little boy and fishing in creeks, man. That was what I did. There was a creek. Anybody down here in Baldwin County knows about it. It runs through the Lake Forest subdivision, and that creek has been the subject of a lot of controversy over the past 50 years, from damming it and just the sediment runoff that they had when they built that community, and runoff from the sewage plant that they built there. But that creek went right through my backyard where I grew up, and oh man, I love to get in that creek and catch all the different panfish and the handful of black bass. You'd catch bullhead cats, and it was always fun. Like we didn't really have a boat growing up. Every now and then we'd have a friend that would, give us access to one. We'd borrow a boat, or somebody would take you out, and that was always cool. But man, you could just go every day. After you've done with school, you could run down there to the creek, and you just didn't need a lot. As long as you could find a hook somewhere. And I know my dad, bless his heart, he had to have got sick of me rummaging through tackle boxes. And you know how kids are. Like, if you get through your supply of hooks, then next thing you're finding a little pair of snips and you're cutting the treble hook off of a Rapala so that you can thread a worm on it, and
I've done it.
whatever you got to do, digging in the flower bed for worms, or stealing hot dog buns out of the house. And then I guess I never, most people move on to bigger and better things, but for me, like you said, like wade fishing, getting up in a little creek, man. Give me a creek I've never been in before that's got a hard bottom, don't have too much mud oozing up between my toes. And preferably if I can see a little bit, see where I'm walking and walk without sinking up to my hips in some muck, man, I can stay there all day or until I run out of bug spray. And then yeah, I'm lucky too. My wife, I went through a spell where I hunted more than I fished, and then I just woke up one day. We bought a place up here on the river, Tensaw River, and me and my wife would go canoeing, and then we started fishing a little bit. And I can't remember the exact moment it hit me, but I remember there being a summer where it was like, you do all this hunting and you got a wife who asks you to go fishing. Like, you should lean into that. There's people that would kill for that, for their wife to want to go fishing. And it's like, so you might as well just do it. So yeah, I like it. That's something that's important to me, family. And then, like you said, taking people to fish, that's something that I'm looking forward to. I got a daughter, and I cannot wait. Like, she's already been fishing, she's been on canoe rides, she's been on backpacking trips up in North Alabama, and I'm just waiting until she's got the hand-eye coordination.
Oh yeah, it's gonna happen, buddy. That's what I'm hoping was this little one I got, man. He's gonna be a fishing fool.
Yeah, won't have a choice, huh? He'll just grow up in it, won't know anything different.
He'll have to.
Well, man, tell me, not looking to bust up all your secret spots and stuff like that, but is there, you talk about mainly wading, and I know the Tennessee River is a big river. I know that there's a lot of impoundments on it, which means that, sometimes that water backs up into some of them feeder creeks. Is there a lot of good wading opportunity up there around the Tennessee River?
It's almost too much to keep up with up
Oh,
here.
Lordy.
There's a few. I'll try not to name names. I know how some people are. There's a few. I mean, it wouldn't take you much. Google Maps around Florence, you'll find blue lines to fish. I've never had a problem wading around here. Nothing. I've never had any problem out of anybody or nothing like that. It's always been, full speed. Nobody gets in your way. It's always been a really great place to fish, and it's not overlooked, but it kind of is, especially for smallmouth. And I talked to a lot of people, and I got a lot of people that have never caught smallmouth. They may be from like down south Alabama, or they may be, I've had, Florida, or I had one guy from Indiana. He was a smallmouth fishing fool. But most of the time I get people, they have no idea what a smallmouth bass is, or what it looks like, or what it eats, or what it wants, or they just know they want to catch one. It's usually a bucket list fish. I'm like, man, a bucket list fish? I've been catching my whole life. I don't know about a bucket list fish, but.
I had that moment myself last year. So Matt Lewis got me into fishing for red eye bass, which I thought was just the coolest thing ever. You know, like a little talk about somebody loves creek fishing and wading. Like you're telling me there's a bass that don't get bigger than 12 inches and, you know, lives up in little high elevation streams and eats bugs. And like you got to
It's
crawl through
top
the
water all
bushes.
year.
Yeah, you got to crawl through the bushes to get to him. I was like, man, sign me up. That's awesome. And so he helped me with that. And then he was like, well, I wouldn't mind a spot to go after some chain pickerel. And it was so cool. Like that's a fish where it's like, yeah, down here in the Delta, like they're everywhere. You know, you get up in any backwater creek and there's more pickerel than bass, you know. Well, I took him and we fished for a little bit and he got on one pretty good sized fish and we took pictures, did the grip and grin and everything, and then he was like, well, man, he said, I got to reach in that cooler, get a celebratory beer. He said, that's the first time I've ever caught a chain pickerel. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, never caught one. He was like, yeah, no. He said, that was, like you said, a bucket list fish. And like that made my whole year. Like, I'm still riding that high just to put somebody on a fish that you're familiar with and exposing somebody to that. It lets you see it from their perspective. You know, like for the rest of the day, I kind of got to see what he was seeing in the fish, you know, how lean they are, how fierce they are. Like you get used to it, but when you have somebody new, it just rekindles that excitement.
It does. It makes you feel young again. You know, it makes me feel like I'm 10, 11, 12 year old and I've snagged my first smallmouth out of a little feeder creek somewhere.
Yeah, there we
I get to
go.
live that all over again.
Yeah, exactly. You get to a point where you've done it enough that it's like, well, you know, don't get me wrong, it's still nice sometimes to have a day to yourself hunting, fishing, whatever the case is. But I'm finally getting that stage in the outdoorsman life cycle where if I could go duck hunt by myself, or if I can go duck hunt with somebody who's never duck hunted before, I would rather take the new guy and just leave my gun at the house and just bring my dog and bring my calls and be like, wait a second, you've never watched ducks come down on decoys at crack of dawn, you know, heard wings whistling over your head, like a come on, get in the truck. This is gonna be great. You'll love
Man, I have some horrible duck stories.
it.
There's one of them I don't like duck hunting because of, man. I never got into duck hunting after that.
I hear you. Hey, duck hunting, I tell people like that's the end of your life as a productive citizen for sure. I'd say that is not duck hunters are not a better class of losers.
Yep.
Well, tell me, man, tell about smallmouth bass. I know that they're black bass, but I know that they do have differences, you know, from the largemouth and the spots that people catch. So what do you find? I guess what's your tactic for success this time of the year fishing for them? Is it the same old bass fishing that everybody's familiar with, or is there anything different about it that you feel is helpful?
I think it's a little bit different as far as like I call them green fish. That's just what I call them, you know, largemouth spots. But as far as green fish, it's a little different. Where you find them is different. Sometimes during the year, or is that early spring, they tend to hang out in what I call green fish water, which is that still non-flowing, just logs, nasty water. And now they're actually getting off into the runs now, and I look for little pools, little eddies off of runs. I tell people, if you hook a smallmouth, you're not going to think that they're lazy at all, but they're a pretty lazy fish, in my opinion. They tend to like to sit behind something, sit over to the side where they ain't got to move or use any energy to move. And they're just waiting for something to come by or come over them and they're going to kill it. But so if you can kind of take that and apply that, you'll on the water, you'll kind of see what I'm talking about as far as fishing the edges of runs and stuff like that. Or, you know, being able to read water helps out a lot. Chunk rock. I love fishing chunk rock. Oh man, they love hiding behind chunk rock.
Chunk rock. I'm not familiar down here. We got more sand than we got rock.
Just big rock, any kind of not like gravelly rock, you know, like a normal bottom, but they're there too. But if you got a big rock somewhere in the middle of a run, more than likely he's sitting behind that rock.
Just holding up in that little pocket, being lazy.
Yep, just being lazy, man. They're lazy as all get out.
So let's say this time of year you're wade fishing and you got a river and you know there's a run up ahead and you got that rock and you're sitting there thinking, oh yeah, there's gonna be one right there. Are you throwing top water? Are you throwing a crawfish pattern? Are you gonna, you know, swim a streamer by them? What's your tactic? What's your move?
I'm more of a bait fish streamer kind of guy. I like my top water, don't get me wrong, but I like that mid column. I don't much care for crawl fishing, especially with a fly rod. I don't. I fish crawls, don't get me wrong, but I'm more of a Helgramite kind of guy on a fly rod than I am a crawl. I just need, as far as like a bait fish streamer, I mean, it could be anything from a woolly bugger to like a cone head or a slump buster, something like just enough weight to get it underneath the water there in that mid column. And I like to work a drift for smallmouth. So I'll say if you have a rock there and there's a pole behind it, I'm going to throw that fly up above the rock and let it, mend my line and come through that hole and let the current do the work. I strip a lot of flies too, but I'm probably more successful on drifting flies than I am stripping flies.
It's kind of funny what you're describing right there, kind of casting and letting the current kind of take it through. I was up kind of fishing in Coosa County a couple weekends ago, and I'm down here. If you could see out my window right now, looking in the backyard, I mean, when we talk about current, it's nothing like you have up there. And so it's very different. We're fishing still water, and you get up there fishing current, what you're talking about, mending line and trying to keep everything straight, that's something I still struggle with. But that's what I was getting on some spotted bass that way, just kind of letting. I found that out instead of drifting or swinging a fly or all of that, just kind of letting it, pull through that pocket, let the current pull it through a pocket of calm water. Well, for your streamer, we got different guys who believe different things. Some people's big on just kind of shape and size and the general impression. Some people are big on color. Some people are not very particular on color. What's your thoughts on your streamer?
I'm not big on color per se. There's a few flies that I have that I tie for myself, and for clients that I use strictly for color. But I'm more or less a size kind of guy. Like right here, right now, there's a ton of bait fish that are probably about as long as your pointer finger. And so, you hear fly fishermen, match the hatch type deal with like a bug. I do the same thing with a minnow just because that's what they see every day. That's what they're going to eat every day. He may be sitting there eating 2-inch bait fish all day long, and then you roll through there with a 4, 5, 6 inch, big streamer. And don't get me wrong, they catch fish, but I find it more successful to kind of match that minnow size. Some days I'll have flies that don't have any sort of flash in them. I probably lean more toward a fly that don't flash than a real flashy fly. But there's some days where those that flash is just what they want. They don't care what size it is or what color it is, as long as it flashes, they'll eat it. I'm big on purple. I'm really big on purple for smallmouth. A lot of my personal best fish have come off like size 4 purple woolly boogers or purple crystal boogers. I don't fish them a whole lot anymore. I keep them in my boat all the time, but if I'm wade fishing, I'm definitely throwing a purple woolly booger. Other than that, I have a cone head that I throw, and I really believe in it. It's pure chartreuse. It's chartreuse feathers out the butt and chartreuse craft fur.
I like it. You can't see because this is audio recording, but as you were talking about your size 4 woolly bugger, I leaned over here at my desk and I wrote me a note down. I've tied some woolly buggers, but purple isn't a color I've tied yet. And it's I know it's not strictly a natural color, but I know I had a friend growing up and he would joke, people would ask, good fishing lures for this, fishing lures for that. And he would say, man, it doesn't matter what it is, purple worm, everything else is irrelevant. He's like, he said, the rest of the stuff is just there so that they can fill Bass Pro up. He said they
That's
do.
it.
He said they'd do just as good if they had just walked in and just asked you how many you wanted, how many packs of purple worms you want. He said
Purple and June bug, buddy.
they could simplify that whole business operation. How many you want? Three? Here you go.
Yep.
$19.
Exactly.
Get out of here, go
I'm the
have
same
fun.
way, man. It's purple or chartreuse. They're not hitting chartreuse. They're gonna hit purple or purple and black. I love a purple and black half and half too. That's became one of my favorite flies here lately, especially with clients. It's probably my go-to for clients because it's easy to fish. And I've always talked a lot of mess about a clouser. I'm not catching fish. I'll be honest. I started fishing clousers when I started fly fishing. I never caught fish on them, but it's just like everybody that I fish with can catch them on clousers or half and halves.
My version of that, and it's funny that you say that because I have some Clouser minnows and I don't know that I've caught a fish on them, but I've caught a bunch of fish on woolly buggers. But my version of that is a spinner bait. Like
Yep.
everybody loves a spinnerbait, and I cannot. I hate fishing spinnerbaits. Like I'd rather fish anything else. Crankbaits, plastic worms, jigging pigs. Like give me anything.
I'll throw anything but a spinnerbait.
Please don't make me throw a spinnerbait. And I know guys who hammer them, and that's their confidence bait. That's their purple worm. You know, like if I had to fish one thing for the rest of my life, give me a spinnerbait. And I'm just like, dang, the only thing worse than a spinnerbait's a
Oh
chatterbait.
man, I don't. There's not a chatterbait allowed in my boat.
That's funny. That's funny.
I
Well,
don't
man,
allow a chatterbait.
that's funny. Well, there's too many similarities between your childhood fishing experiences, fishing with your wife. Like at some point, me and my wife gonna have to come up there, and we're gonna have to hang out. For other people listening in, if they want to come up there and fish the Tennessee River with you, do some wade fishing for smallmouth this summer, what's a good way to get a hold of you?
So you can just get a hold of me through the Fly Fishing in Alabama Instagram page or through Steven Rockerts. You can get through him through that, or you can get through to me on Instagram or Facebook at just Andy Witten. That's it's ANDE. It's spelled a little different, but you can do that, or like I said, through Rockerts or the Fly Fishing Alabama Instagram, Facebook, or the website.
There we go. Well, guys, y'all definitely go check him out. And Andy, enjoyed talking to you. Appreciate you being on the show today.
Yeah, man, I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little smallmouth.
This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by. All right, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And again, don't forget to text that code ALFFR to 779-345-2918. Again, just text ALFFR, it's Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report, to 779-345-2918. Subscribe to our email list and we'll send you the promo code via email. This week's episode of the Alabama Freshwater Fishing Report has been brought to you by Fish Bites. Whether you're hitting the sand with set rig or fishing the flats and marshes for speckled trout, redfish, and flounder, Fish Bites has something for you. Check out the full line of scented saltwater and freshwater baits at fishbites.com. Also by Southeastern Pond Management. Since 1989, Southeastern Pond Management has been a leader in pond and lake management services. Schedule an obligation-free consultation today. Call 1-888-830-POND or info@sepond.com. Also brought to you by Killer Dock. Killer Dock combines durability, function, and design to uniquely upgrade your entire dock experience. Visit killerdock.com to see more.